طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and continued in his memory by a group of his colleagues. This is John Roberts. This morning I'd like to share a great moment in the British Parliament on February 5th, when the Member of Parliament Sir Gerald Kaufman rose to speak in a debate on the humanitarian situation in Gaza. But first, as an introduction to Sir Gerald Kaufman, I would like to play a speech he gave in the House of Commons on April 2002 during Israel's controversial military operation codename Defensive Shield.
Madam Deputy Speaker, I was brought up a Jew and a Zionist. On a shelf in our kitchen was a tin box of the Jewish National Fund, into which we put coins to help the pioneers building a Jewish presence in Palestine. I first went to Israel in 1961, and I've been there since more times than I can count. I had family in Israel, and I have friends in Israel. One of them fought in the wars of 1956, 1967, and 1973, and was wounded in two of them. The tie-clip which I'm wearing is made from a campaign decoration awarded to him, which he presented to me. I've known most of the prime ministers of Israel, starting with the founding prime minister, David Ben-Gurion. Golda Meir was my friend. So was Yigal Alon, the deputy prime minister, who as a general won the Negev for Israel in the 1948 War of Independence. My parents came to Britain as refugees from Poland. Most of their families were subsequently murdered by the Nazis in the Holocaust. My grandmother was ill in bed when the Nazis came to her hometown of Staszów. A German soldier shot her dead in her bed. Madam Deputy Speaker, my grandmother did not die to provide cover for Israeli soldiers murdering Palestinian grandmothers in Gaza. The present Israeli government ruthlessly and cynically exploit the continuing guilt among Gentiles over the slaughter of Jews in the Holocaust as justification for their murder of Palestinians. The implication is that Jewish lives are precious, but the lives of Palestinians do not count. On Sky News a few days ago, the spokeswoman for the Israeli army, Major Leibovich, was asked about the Israeli killing of, at that time, 800 Palestinians. The total is now 1,000. She replied instantly, 500 of them were militants. That was the reply of a Nazi. I suppose that Jews fighting for their lives in the Warsaw Ghetto could have been dismissed as militants. The Israeli Foreign Minister, Tzipi Livni, asserts that her government will have no dealings with Hamas because they're terrorists. Tzipi Livni's father was Eitan Livni, chief operations officer of the terrorist Irgun Svai Leumi, who organized the blowing up of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, in which 91 victims were killed, including four Jews. Israel was born out of Jewish terrorism. Jewish terrorists hanged two British sergeants and booby-trapped their corpses. Irgun, together with the terrorist Stern Gang, massacred 254 Palestinians in 1948 in the village of Deir Yassin. Today, the present Israeli government indicate that they will be willing, in circumstances acceptable to them, to negotiate with the Palestinian president, Abbas, of Fatah, It's too late for that, Madam Deputy Speaker. They could have negotiated with Fatah's previous leader, Yasser Arafat, who was a friend of mine. Instead, they besieged him in a bunker in Ramallah, where I visited him. It's because of the failings of Fatah since Arafat's death that Hamas won the election, the Palestinian election in 2006. Hamas is a deeply nasty organization, but it was democratically elected, and it is the only game in town. The boycotting of Hamas, including by our own government, has been a culpable error from which dreadful consequences have followed. The great Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Eban, with whom I campaigned for peace on many platforms, said, "You make peace by talking to your enemies." However many Palestinians the Israelis murder in Gaza, they cannot solve this existential problem by military means. Whenever and however the fighting ends, there will still be 1.5 million Palestinians in Gaza and 2.5 million more Palestinians in the West Bank, who are treated like dirt by the Israelis, with hundreds of roadblocks and with the ghastly denizens of the illegal Jewish settlements harassing them as well. The time will come, not so long from now, when they will outnumber the Jewish population in Israel. It's time for our government to make clear to the Israeli government that its conduct and policies are unacceptable, and to impose a total arms ban on Israel. It is time for peace, but real peace, not the solution by conquest, which is the Israelis' real goal, but which is impossible for them to achieve. They're not simply war criminals, they're fools.
That was Sir Gerald Kaufman speaking on the floor of the British House of Commons in April of 2002. Here is what Sir Gerald Kaufman said in the House of Commons on February 5th, 2014. "I once led a delegation of 60 parliamentarians from 13 European parliaments to Gaza. I could no longer do that today because Gaza is practically inaccessible. The Israelis try to lay the responsibility on the Egyptians, but although the Egyptians' closing of the tunnels has caused great hardship, it is the Israelis who have imposed the blockade and are the occupying power. The culpability of the Israelis was demonstrated in the report to the United Nations by Richard Goldstone, following the Operation Cast Lead. After his report, he was harassed by Jewish organizations. At the end of a meeting I had with him in New York, his wife said to me, 'It is good to meet another self-hating Jew.' Again and again, Israel seeks to justify the vile injustices that it imposes on the people of Gaza and the West Bank on the grounds of the Holocaust. The statistics are appalling. There is fresh water only for a few hours every 5 days. Fishing boats are not allowed to go out. In any case, what is the point? Because the waters are so filthy that no fish they catch can be eaten. The Israelis are victimizing the children above all. Half the population of this country is under the voting age. What is being done to those children? The lack of nutrition is damaging not only their bodies and brains, it will go on for generation after generation. It is totally unacceptable that the Israelis should behave in such a way, but they do not care. Go to Tel Aviv, as I did not long ago, and watch them sitting complacently outside their pavement cafes. They do not give a damn about their fellow human beings, perhaps a half an hour away. The time when we could condemn and think that that was enough has long passed. The Israelis do not care about condemnation. They are self-righteous and complacent. We must now take action against them. We must impose sanctions. If the spineless Obama will not do it, we must do it, even unilaterally. We must press the European community for all to be done. These people cannot be persuaded. We cannot appeal to their better nature when they do not have one. It is all very well saying, wicked, wicked Hamas. Hamas is dreadful. I've met people from Hamas, but nothing it has done justifies punishing children, women, the sick, as Israelis are doing now. They must be stopped. As has been pointed out, there is a time limit for what we are talking about. The idea that things can go on while we wait for a two-state solution is gone. Sooner or later, the Palestinians will say, we are dying anyway, so let's die for something. Let us stop that. I do not want a war. I do not want violent action. But the action that the international community takes must be imposed. Otherwise, hell will break loose. Those are the words of Sir Gerald Kaufman, spoken to the British House of Commons on February 5th, 2014. The feature presentation today is an interview with Eva Bartlett, who has been called Canada's Rachel Corrie. She's an activist and journalist who has been living in Gaza since 2008, which is about 5 years. As a volunteer with the International Solidarity Movement, Eva has been accompanying Gaza farmers and fishermen under the threat of harassment and sniper fire from Israeli forces. She rode with medics in their ambulances during Operation Cast Lead, Israel's devastating assault on Gaza in 2008-2009 that killed more than 1,400 Gazans. She has documented the 2012 Israeli attacks from a hospital in the central Gaza Strip. Eva Bartlett is coming to the Boston-Cambridge area and will be speaking Friday, February 28th at the Community Church of Boston, 565 Boylston Street in Copley Square. Her second appearance will be Sunday, March 2nd in the Hastings Room at the First Church in Cambridge Congregational, 11 Garden Street, next to the Sheraton Commander Hotel. As a preview of coming attractions, here is an interview with Eva Bartlett by Mike McCormick on the radio show Mind Over Matter.
We are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Eva Bartlett. Eva Bartlett has been called Canada's Rachel Corrie. She is a human rights activist and journalist living in Gaza since 2008. Her eyewitness accounts from occupied Palestine have been published in the Electronic Intifada, Interpress Service, Countercurrents, and her own blog, ingaza.wordpress.com. As a volunteer with the International Solidarity Movement, she accompanies Gazan farmers and fishers under threat of harassment and sniper fire from Israeli forces. And she rode with medics in the ambulances during the Operation Cast Lead, Israel's devastating military assault on Gaza, which began December 27, 2008. And she documented the 2012 attacks from a central Gaza Strip hospital. Eva, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
You're very welcome.
So start out, tell us, how did you get involved in the issue of Palestine and Israel?
In a way that maybe is not the normal way. I mean, I don't come from any family ties to the region. I don't have any particular faith that brought me to the issue. It was more, I was 28 years old. I was traveling quite a bit and starting to kind of wake up to the world and seek out news. And as I sought out news online, I came across things that I'd never heard of on corporate media, including Palestine. So I started just researching more. And the more I researched and learned, I mean, I went from zero knowledge whatsoever on Palestine or Israel to seeing all sorts of things that, again, as I said, were not being shown on TV or in the corporate newspapers. And as I researched more, I was both appalled at what was going on and has been going on for over six decades, and also by my ignorance. And I thought, why am I so ignorant on this issue? Why haven't I heard of this? And I now know the answer because we're not really allowed to hear about it in the corporate media. But the more I learned, the more I wanted to actually go to Palestine and see for myself. And that was more or less the progression. I studied, I read for a couple of years, and then I eventually went to occupied Palestine.
And how did you choose to go there? Did you take a group tour?
I've never been much for group tours, to be honest. In my research, I came across the work of the International Solidarity Movement, which I'll refer to as the ISM for the sake of ease, and decided that their work, their volunteerism, appealed to me because Their principles are that they are Palestinian-led, so they're not like a kind of colonial movement going over and imposing Western ideas on Palestinians, but also that they're nonviolent and they witness and they document through writing and photography and videos. And they go to areas where many journalists are not going and not covering, so they see the worst aspects in the case of the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem of the occupation, and in the case of the Gaza Strip, of the military occupation of Gaza and the daily life and struggle of Palestinians there. So, yes, yeah, so to finish my answer, I decided that I would go to the West Bank and to see, to participate with ISM for as long as I could, see, you know, what is life like under occupation. I'd read about it, but to actually see it is something quite different than just reading about it.
And that initial trip was 8 months. Is that right?
Correct, yeah. I went in May 2007, and I went independently via Jordan. Actually, for the first couple of weeks before I met with the ISM and joined and began volunteering throughout the occupied West Bank, I did meet with a group of Palestinians and Israelis who worked together to raise awareness. They're called Combatants for Peace. And I had met some of them online through their website and contacted them and said that I want to meet with your group and, you know, hear what you're doing, just to get a sense of the other side, the narrative that the Israelis had to say. And they're similar to Breaking the Silence in that they comprise both Palestinians and Israelis, and the Israelis were former soldiers, and they talk about why that either stopped being a soldier altogether or, you know, stopped participating in being a soldier in, say, the so-called occupied territories. So I met with them, and I went to some of their meetings for about 2 weeks, and then I joined the ISM, and for about 8 months was all over the occupied West Bank, witnessing, you know, the atrocities and the crimes of the illegal colonists and of the soldiers against Palestinians. And unfortunately, for anybody that stands for justice for Palestinians, it's very difficult both to enter and to remain in the West Bank. So after 8 months, I was no longer able to remain.
And can you expand a little bit on what you saw while you were there during that 8 months?
Sure. I spent some weeks in Khalil, excuse me, otherwise known as Hebron. And Hebron is notable because it is in the occupied West Bank. It's theoretically under Palestinian control, but it is an occupied city. And there are illegal Jewish colonies throughout the city. In Tel Rameda, which is a district of Hebron, there are, I think it's about 400 illegal settlers who basically have the run of that area of Hebron. And they are backed by the Israeli army. The colonists, they carry rifles, they aggress Palestinians whenever they wish, they take over Palestinian homes, and they've basically, in that area, they've shut down the main street, Shat HaShuhada, or Street of the Martyrs, which used to be one of the most prosperous streets in Hebron, and now is basically a ghost town on which Palestinians are afraid to even walk because they're aggressed, and even school children trying to get to school are aggressed by these colonists. So our work entailed accompanying Palestinians as they tried to walk in the street or simply sitting and being a presence on the street in hopes of deterring this violence against the Palestinians. In other areas south of Hebron, I stayed for many months in an area called the South Hebron Hills, and specifically in a hamlet called Susia, where Palestinians who had been living in both in stone homes that they had lived in for generations and also these unique cave homes had been expelled in the mid-80s by the Israeli authorities, who had taken the area and called it a closed military zone, which is a common tactic for annexing land in Palestine, and had expelled the Palestinians. And these people, homeless, basically had nowhere to go, so they ended up hundreds of meters away from their former homes, now living in ramshackle tents built of scraps of tin and plastic, etc. And meanwhile, their homes, which were first, the area was first made into a closed military zone, was now made into a so-called archaeological park, lauding that this was, these were Jewish homes from way back when, and the inhabitants that actually had lived there just a couple of decades before are now living in these shoddy tents across the road, being aggressed by a colonist from the illegal settlement of Susia, who, and most settlements, by the way, are on hilltops, which are, you know, advantageous in many ways, but the settlers would come down from their hilltop colony and aggress the Palestinians, steal or kill their sheep, poison their water. This kind of thing has been going on for years. So in that area, we would sleep in their tents, again with the hopes of deterring such violence from both the colonists and the Israeli army that had a base nearby. and also to enable the Palestinians to graze their sheep or to work their land, and to document the aggressions when they occurred. In other areas, we spent time in cities like Nablus, which is in northern West Bank, or in smaller towns like Azoun or Deristia, which were at the time in 2007 coming under regular Israeli military invasions, in which a so-called curfew, which is really a lockdown, would be imposed for anywhere from a few days to entire months. And so when the army imposes a curfew, and again, that's a very innocent-sounding word because it sounds like a teen being home late, a curfew is actually the army will come in and they will be, their horns will be blaring, they will have bullhorns or megaphones saying, get in your house, basically paraphrasing here, get in your house, if you're not in your house, you know, we'll arrest you or shoot you, and they do this. So basically what happens is Palestinians are trapped in their homes, again sometimes for days or weeks on end, especially in Nablus, it was notorious. And so they can't get to work, they can't get to hospital, they can't get to buy food, to school, etc. And often Palestinians are outside of their home when a curfew is enforced. So if they dare to try to reach their home, they risk being either arrested by the Israeli army or shot. So in cases like that, we would accompany Palestinians back to their home, or we would bring them food or bread or whatever it was they needed, medicine, walking in the streets when they could not do so. So, I mean, and also documenting what happened after the army would leave. Often they would have invaded a home and occupied the house for however long the army happened to be in the city. And in that case, often the house had been trashed, maybe shot up by machine gun fire. Families kept in one room, denied, you know, access to food and water, maybe water, but denied access to food and medicine. So it was a lot of documenting, taking their testimonies, and basically being their microphone, because they all have stories to tell. And unfortunately, they don't really get the microphone. They don't get the media to tell what they're enduring on a daily basis. So that's another aspect of the work we do, is to say, not say, this is about me. No, this is about the Palestinians with whom we're standing and who have a voice but are largely ignored.
In your website, ingaza.wordpress.com, you link to numerous videos, some of which show, for instance, members like yourself out with farmers while they're picking what I believe were lentils and being like shot at regularly. And I mean, it's amazing footage, because someone is interviewing one of the, who I think is an ISM member, that's trying to stay standing for the interview while these shots are like whizzing by.
Mm-hmm.
Is that normal from what people can?
It is normal. It also includes parsley and sometimes chickpeas. Basically, with regards to the border regions in Gaza, the Israeli authorities have unilaterally imposed a so-called buffer zone or a no-go zone. And it has been expanded by the Israeli authorities unilaterally to what they say is 300 meters. But there's a few points to note about that. One is that there's no clear demarcation of where 300 meters are. The Palestinians know more or less because this is their land and they know every inch of it. But from the Israeli side, you know, they can shoot up to 2 kilometers and say the Palestinians were in the buffer zone. And this is documented by the UN, by the way. They've shelled and attacked Palestinians well over 300 meters and up to 2 kilometers. So this buffer zone annexes one-third of Palestinian farmland. And Gaza, as most of us know, is a very small strip of land. It's only 40 kilometers long. It's only at its widest 12 kilometers. So the buffer zone annexing one-third of their land, with 1.7 million people living in this strip, it's a huge impact on their ability to produce nutritious and cheap food. So you have that, which then ties into the overall situation of manufactured unemployment and poverty in Gaza, but also the fact that Palestinians are again being dispossessed of their land, again having more land annexed through various Israeli policies and taken away from them. So, you know, since 67, they've had the Green Line border, and now for the last decade or more, they've lost that, say, 500 meters along the border. So steadily encroaching on more and more Palestinian land, steadily the Israeli authorities are annexing more land. But as far as how they enforce this policy, you have military towers all along the border, some of which are remotely controlled towers. So you have Israeli soldiers miles away, perhaps in Tel Aviv, in booths similar to this radio booth, but with screens, monitors, and joysticks, and basically they can fire upon whomever they wish whenever given the order, or I don't know how the procedure is. But the point is that they're removed from actually being physically present, and in some senses it's almost like a game. And there's some good articles about that particular aspect of attacking Palestinians. But otherwise you have Israeli jeeps constantly patrolling the border. And so in my personal experience, and I was there for doing this accompaniment for a year and a half, and more often than not, what we would see was Israeli jeeps patrolling the border, and they do it all hours of the day. And if we were with farmers on the land, say, 500 meters away, so outside of the theoretical buffer zone, we'd see the soldiers stop. Often they'd start shooting right away. Often they'd stop and just watch. And so another few points to note is that with the Israeli policies of bulldozing in the border regions and destroying the once very fertile region where, you know, it was host to olive and nut and fruit trees and all sorts of crops, and now it's basically, if you've seen my videos or photos or other ISM photos, you see that it looks flat. It's brown and flat and dry and arid looking and almost like it's inhospitable to life. It's in fact very fertile land, but because it has been so ravaged, you can see with the naked eye. We could see, and my eyesight isn't super, but I could see, you know, the Israeli jeeps 500 meters away, and they can certainly see with their surveillance equipment exactly who's on the land, exactly who they're targeting. And nonetheless, they continue to shoot on, again, with these military towers or with their machine guns on their person. They continue to shoot on a daily basis at Palestinian farmers, which include elders, young men and women, children. And this is a policy of harassment because, again, in many instances, they would look at the Palestinian farmers who happen to be either sowing the land or harvesting their wheat or parsley, nothing higher than, say, knee-height crops or waist-height. And in many cases, the army would watch before doing anything and maybe take off and come back and watch and take off. One of the videos I show shows farmers who have spent 2 hours on their land harvesting parsley. And these are, the majority of them were farm laborers being paid a very small amount per day, which they contribute to their family's income. And after 2 hours of harvesting on land over 500 meters from the border, and while the farmers are pushing a stalled pickup truck full of this parsley, it's then that the Israeli army chooses to fire on them. When the farmers have their sides to the army, are clearly no threat, and are done their work and trying to leave. And so this is just one incident of many times which I've seen. It's pure harassment. And so the Israeli army spokesperson might say these are warning shots. But in my understanding, a warning shot, first of all, there's a reason for it. So the farmers are outside of the Israeli imposed buffer zone. And second of all, the warning shots would be fired in the air and not at the body. So in our experience, yes, you do have bullets whizzing past your head. You can hear them go past you, or you can see the puffs of dirt around your feet and your legs. These are not warning shots. And tens of farmers have been killed and hundreds have been injured, maimed, while working the border regions. And I also always note that maybe for people who want a more credible NGO, Defense for Children International has various reports, which they update regularly, on just looking at children in the border areas, so children farmers and children doing other work in border regions. And they have documented children who have been killed and maimed by these Israeli policies on Palestinian land.
You were in Gaza when Operation Cast Lead was initiated, and can you talk about that? You rode with ambulances, right?
Yeah. So, I just as a prelude, I and the other ISM activists got to Gaza by boat because of the Israeli control of Palestinian borders and airspace. So, obviously, of course, Palestinians don't have a functioning airport. It was bombed back in the early years of 2000. And Israel controls all the borders with the exception of the Rafah crossing controlled by Egypt, which, under the Mubarak regime at the time, was as complicit as Israel in locking down Gaza's land borders. So there were five boats that sailed from Cyprus to Gaza in a successful attempt, to break the Israeli control, the blockade of Gaza. Israel does still control Palestinian waters illegally. But that said, at the time of the attacks, there were about seven, I believe it was, ISM activists, or maybe five ISMers and two other internationals that were doing activist work. And in the weeks leading up to the December 27th attacks, The Israeli authorities had kept the borders closed to foreign journalists and aid workers. So there was actually a dearth of witnesses. And after the first week or so of attacks, or maybe it was the first 4 days, the Israeli authorities announced that they would open the Erez crossing in Gaza's north and that foreign passport holders should leave, thereby clearing out more witnesses. But, of course, we didn't want to leave because we knew that this was only going to get worse. And after about the first roughly week, we decided that we would accompany medics because by that point, already two Palestinian medics had been killed and many more injured while doing their work, which is sanctioned, obviously, under international law and the Geneva Conventions. They had been targeted by the Israeli army. And this is not a new thing. Historically, Israel does target medics, both in the West Bank and in Gaza. So we decided that if we had held a press conference, and we decided that if we were able to accompany medics, maybe we could ensure them a degree of safety to do their work, and thereby also aid the Palestinians who are desperately in need of medical help, and also to document the worst of the atrocities and the war crimes. So accompanying medics, we did see, in my experience, I saw a medic be sniped by an Israeli sniper in northeastern Gaza. Thankfully, he survived. Another medic I worked with was killed. He was shredded by a dart bomb, which holds anywhere from 4,000 or 5,000 inch-and-a-half long razor-sharp darts, which are designed to spread in kind of an arc and impact as many victims as possible. But in this case, it was fired directly at his ambulance, so he was assaulted with probably hundreds of darts, and he died of shock. And this was a medic simply responding to Palestinians' calls for help. And we also witnessed things like the use of the illegal white phosphorus on civilian areas and, you know, what it did to people, obviously killing them or badly disfiguring them. So for 23 days, and I always note that the attacks continued beyond the 22nd day, beyond the ceasefire, because even beyond the midnight ceasefire, Israel was still bombing and still shooting on Palestinians. And from day one, they were violating the ceasefire, firing on, again, civilians and farmers. So it was, for me, it was, I'd never seen anything like it. You know, I'm just a small town girl from Ontario. I'd never heard or seen a bombing. I'd never seen a body, you know, killed by bombing. I quickly learned, seeing, you know, the medics bring in bodies or people who had been badly injured. And in the end, you know, people who died from their injuries, it was well over 1,450 Palestinians in that 23 days who were killed and well over 5,000 who were injured. And some of these injuries were horrific, again, by white phosphorus or by shrapnel to the head, to the body. And also, I always note that whereas the Israeli authorities would say they were strategically striking so-called terrorist spots, you know, where Hamas police stations, etc., what they were doing was bombing a very small, densely inhabited strip where civilians had no ability to flee. They're locked into this very small area, unlike other so-called war zones. This is not a war zone because it was a one-sided war on Gaza. But unlike other areas, they could not leave. So they were basically like fish in a barrel being attacked. They had no bomb shelters. They had no air raid sirens. And everywhere, including UN institutions and schools, including mosques and kindergartens and markets and homes and hospitals and medical centers, they were all targets.
Yeah, I believe an interview with you had the stat of 100 targets in the first 220 seconds of Operation Gaslight. So we've got about 7 minutes left. Can you bring us up to date on the situation in Gaza now?
It's a dire situation now. So, I mean, Gaza has suffered over the years, over at least since 2006, from power outages. One of the main reasons being that in 2006, the Israeli Air Force bombed Gaza's only power plant. And with the Israeli restrictions on construction materials entering Gaza and other things like, hospital equipment, medical equipment, but also the parts needed to rehabilitate the power plant, Palestinians in Gaza haven't been able to fully repair their plant. They've brought in through the tunnels the lifeline that now themselves have been largely destroyed. They had brought in small replacement parts for, and I'm not a technician, so I can't really say exactly what they brought in to fix the power plant. But it was nevertheless, it was never fixed to 100% capacity. So since 2006, Palestinians in Gaza have suffered these power outages anywhere from, say, 6 hours to 8 hours a day, which impacts on your personal life, which impacts on everything, the ability to pump sewage and water. It impacts on hospitals, etc. But now it's gotten worse. Since the military coup in Egypt in July of this year, the new Egyptian regime has largely destroyed all but, as I read in a UN report, 10% of the tunnels. So these tunnels, again, the Israeli authorities would call them terrorist tunnels. But what were they bringing through? For the most part, they were bringing through food, diapers, baby formula, cars, livestock, fertilizer, seeds, toys, shoes, all the things that were banned by the Israeli authorities, because from mid to late 2007 until around 2010, all but 40 items were banned by the Israeli authorities from entering Gaza. So they actually were banning things like diapers and spices and baby formula and A4 paper, etc., school books. It has been eased somewhat, and there, you know, this is one part of the propaganda tool is that, oh, look, we've eased the restrictions. Well, so you've lessened somewhat the dire restrictions on quality of life in Gaza, but construction materials are still banned, and it's still difficult, unfortunately, with the corruption of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, to get, and with also the Israeli blockade in Gaza, it's still difficult to get fuel into Gaza, both cooking gas and fuel needed for vehicles and to run the power plant. And the solution and alternative had been to bring in, to buy and bring in cheap Egyptian fuel into Gaza, but now this is not possible. So currently, in Gaza, Palestinians suffer up to 18 hours a day of power outages. It's winter now. It's not, they don't get snow like in North America, but it does get cold and it's clammy and they don't have central heating. So it's just on the personal level, it's horrible. You know, short days, no, if your power's out, you don't have lighting, you don't have communication with the world. They already feel isolated by the physical blockade and by the media media outage on Gaza. But now, also, they can't even really, you know, all but 6 to 8 hours a day, they don't have, you know, the means to communicate with the outside world via internet, etc. But more dire than that is that with the dearth of fuel, for example, the sanitation plants can't even pump the sewage into the sea, which is the solution in Gaza, because with all the complexities of the blockade, which have been manufactured by preventing Palestinians from importing the things they need to maintain proper sanitation and sewage lines, in good circumstances, Palestinians were already having to pump 90 million liters of sewage into the sea on a daily basis. Now, with the power outages, they can't even do that. So in Gaza City, in other areas of Gaza, you have sewage holding pools overflowing into the city, and it's also happens to be the rainy season, so you have heavy rains compounding this, so people, you know, children going to school, people going to work, have to wade through sewage to get to where they're going. And this is something, this is not a humanitarian crisis and oh, poor Palestinians, this is something that has been manufactured with the intent of imposing collective punishment on Palestinians. This is something that is completely preventable. Now, 95% of the water in Gaza is undrinkable, according to UN WHO standards. And the sewage flooding the streets, with the power outages, even people who are connected to water lines can't get water because it can't be pumped to them. So there are so many aspects and layers of suffering in Gaza, and the Palestinians in Gaza are not crying out for aid. The last thing they want is aid. They want open borders. They want to be self-sufficient, as they were and can be, and are completely intelligent and capable of being, and, you know, enough with the band-aids. They want a real solution which enables them to live like other human beings and with dignity. But right now they don't have that. Right now they're suffering. And so with my speaking tour, my attempt is merely to educate people, and because I think that our media does not do that. I think that there is a media blackout on Palestine and Gaza specifically. And also to encourage people to take action, whether it's, you know, by lobbying or by educating others or getting involved, because they are our brothers and sisters over there, and they are suffering greatly. And they've been suffering for years, but now it's at a climax.
Heard it's the densest population strip on the planet, in Gaza.
I've heard that too. It's certainly, if it's not the densest, it's certainly one of the densest.
So, a lot of people, and just 2 minutes left, and U.S. and Canada play a significant role in this.
They do, and actually, I have been reading a book by Canadian journalist Eve Engler. It's called Canada and Israel Building Apartheid. And it's interesting because, I mean, many Canadians who are in the know now, who read even a bit of news that is not corporate media, know that Harper is very allied, Stephen Harper, our prime minister, is very allied with the Israeli authorities, and to the extent where in 2006, when Israel was bombing Lebanon and Gaza, it was okay, it was for Israel's security. In 2009, it's okay, Israel's just defending itself. The siege on Gaza, it's okay, just Israeli security. But even prior to that, I mean, Canada does have a sad history of ignoring justice for Palestinians and blindly supporting Israel's policies. And of course, the U.S. does too, supplying billions of dollars of aid and weaponry to Israel on a yearly basis. So this is something where we as citizens need to be taking our parliamentarians or members of Congress and Senate to task and really informing them and challenging them and challenging the Zionist lobby and their control over politicians and not being afraid to speak out. Because you know what? If you're going to be labeled, as we often are, as anti this or that, you know, it's just a smear campaign. And speaking out for justice is the right thing to do. And that's all it is about. It's about justice and humanity.
That was Eva Bartlett, interviewed by Mike McCormick on the radio show Mind Over Matter. Make a note. Eva Bartlett is coming to the Boston-Cambridge area and will be speaking Friday, February 28th at the Community Church of Boston, 565 Boylston Street in Copley Square. Her second appearance will be Sunday, March 2nd in the Hastings Room at the First Church in Cambridge Congregational, 11 Garden Street, next to the Sheraton Commander Hotel. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live at www.wzbc.org. Or listen to us at any time via the WZBC archive found on the homepage. Simply click on Archive, go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.